Yes, loom. This is not difficult. It only takes about 5 minutes to get through. We take up from where we left off yesterday in the outline. So we had gotten almost through the whole text yesterday. The text is divided into four sections: the meaning of the title, the translator's homage, the main body of the text, and the conclusion. We did already the first three points yesterday. But the third point is divided into two parts, the introductory verse and then the rest of the text. So we got through the introductory verse yesterday. The rest of the text is divided into the in the following way. There is a brief presentation and an expanded explanation, and a concluding section which gives some examples. So those are the three parts of the text to follow. Then from among these, the first one, the brief presentation, also has four sections. The first section is pointing out the main idea. The next one is then taking up each of the points under the main idea and explaining the details of those. Then there's a section giving some logical reasoning, the rationale, the grounds or the reasoning for this way of thinking. Then the fourth of these sections is an analysis of how these two, namely samsara and nirvana, or phenomena and their nature, are not the same and they're not different. So that's the outline. Then the first of these points is the pointing out the essence, as called, or giving the main subject matter. So that is done in one verse, which says, a summary of everything in brief should be known to include the following two motifs. Since everything can be summarized briefly in terms of phenomena and likewise pure being. So then the commentary on that says, a summary of everything expressed in the scriptures. So everything here means everything expressed in the scriptures. If one were to put that all into two terms, then phenomena and pure being, or phenomena and their nature, are the two terms that you could use to summarize it all, since everything included under topics of knowledge can be summarized fully in terms of these two. Consequently, if you gain rigorous analytical certainty about these two, that is to say, if you think these two subjects through very clearly and get analytically precise knowledge about them, then you will no longer be unclear in your understanding of any subject expressed in the scriptures. So it's like a key to all of the teachings of the Buddha. That which here... So then the verse goes on to say, that which is classified here as phenomena comprises samsara. Phenomena's pure being is classified most precisely as nirvana, as this is defined by the vehicles, which are three. So that which here in this context is precisely classified as... since there is no other base for what is to be known and relinquished by those aspiring after liberation and omniscience than phenomena whose makeup consists in this deluded mode of appearance. So the fact that there is this dualistic way of appearing, so that the object seems to be separate from the consciousness perceiving it, is a delusion. It's a confusion of the mind, a misunderstanding. And it's that incorrect way appearance happens that is the actual makeup of samsara. And we'll go into it later again, a little bit later in the a few pages down, about why it's a mistaken way of appearance. What is the mistake involved? We'll also hear more about that. So that is that covers very, in a very, very brief way what is meant by phenomena. Then pure being is most precisely classified as being nirvana, as this is defined by the vehicles of which there are three. So in this context, the three vehicles means the Shalakayana, the Pratyekabuddhayana, and the Mahayana. There are other ways of classifying the three vehicles, but in this context, in Sutrayana context, which we are working in, those are the three vehicles. So pure being is classified by these three vehicles as nirvana because it is the attainment of transcendence of misery. The term transcendence of misery is a literal English translation of the word nirvana. Nirvana means transcendence of misery or getting beyond suffering. And this nirvana, this freedom from suffering, involves a complete transformation. So what is nirvana? Nirvana is a complete transformation, complete change. How does it happen? It is brought about by seeing that in samsara, in whatever form that it may appear, there is no self associated with the individual and no essence or no entity within phenomena. So that is what is usually called the two forms of non-self. Any form that samsara could appear in would involve at least one of those forms of self, or both of them. And since neither of them exists, then the transcendence of those two forms of self is transcendence of misery and suffering. So to undergo that transformation, in which one sees that there is no self of either of the two kinds, one comes into harmony with a fundamental mode of being, such that there is no discrepancy between fundamental being and appearance. You should ask questions and start a debate. And when you find all the mistakes in the translation, you should also criticize the translator and start a debate. He didn't say when, he said if you find any mistakes. So then this transformation, which is nirvana, and which is brought about by seeing that there is no form of self, of either connected with the individual or with phenomena, brings one into harmony with, it creates a harmony between the fundamental mode of being and the mode of appearance. Those two terms in Tibetan are netsul and nongsul. Netsul is fundamental mode of being. It means the way things are. The way things really are. Netsul. We'll do this all in Tibetan afterwards again. Okay. Right, so we'll do this mainly in English. Pardon?
The root text and commentary?
Well, mainly the root text. And maybe stick in a few important terms from the commentary in Tibetan also. As much as there's time for. So then, that's the one side of it, the fundamental mode of being, the way things are. The other side is the mode of appearance, which is nongsul, the way things appear, the way they seem to be. So the one is the way they are, the other is the way they seem to be. And these two things in samsara don't go together. The way they seem to be doesn't fit with the way they are, and the way they are doesn't fit with the way they seem to be. We'll see more about why later. Under the second, there are two points, the definition of phenomena and definition of pure being. So now we get these defined. What are the characteristics of each? The first is as follows. So first, definition of phenomena. Here the traits of phenomena are defined as duality and equivalent formulation. the appearance of which is mistaken interpretation. Since what appears is not, it could not be true. No reference have ever existed either and being but concept, they are just interpretation. Yeah, that's just the root verse. Now the commentary comes. And if it's still not clear after the commentary, then you should engage in debate. So we have two important terms here. One is duality, and the other is equivalent formulation. So since Veronica already understood duality, then we don't need to explain that one. We'll go straight to equivalent formulation. No, maybe not. So duality means that there we're talking about the way things appear. The very fact that something appears, it doesn't matter what, that is duality. So it can be a form. So duality takes six different forms. It can be a form, meaning some shape, a combination of shape and color is a form. Or it can be a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or a thought. Those six comprise appearance. And any time there is any of those six, that is dualistic appearance, duality. Why? Because the way it seems to appear is that the form is something separate from the perceiver. There seems to be, for example, a distance between the book perceived and the perceiver of it. The book is over there, the perceiver is over here. That's the way it seems to us. So that's dualistic appearance. And there's no fault in it, actually. That's just the way things seem to be. But that's the first quality of phenomena, that there is this dualistic way things appear. Then that's still not the problem. The problem is that we assume that dualism which seems to be there is actually there. That there is a true duality. That is to say, that the object really exists as something on its own, separate from separate from the perceiving mind. And because we assume that the object and perceiver are different, then we put on terms. And we say, that thing over there, which is not me, is a book. Right? As soon as we put on the term, then it reinforces the idea of that as being real. Because I am not the only one calling it a book. Also, my mother calls it a book. That's very important. Right? That one's mother also calls it a book. That makes it real. Right? And then you notice not only your mother, but your sister and uncles, and then even people you don't even know. You go into the store and you hear somebody ordering a book, complete stranger. And if even strangers call it a book, it must be real, right? So language completely cements the idea of true existence for the dualistic appearance. So the phenomena have these two aspects of first dualistic appearance, then the assumption that it is that way, then the terms being put on. So that's equivalent formulation. There's not a true equivalence between the formulation and the object. They're not completely equal. But the way it says in the commentary is, phenomena are defined as consisting in an appearance in the form of a duality of perceived and perceiver, which in being assumed to have an objectivity equivalent to the way it appears, gives rise to a further appearance, namely the process of formulation implying the medium of nomenclature. Nomenclature means terms, names, terminology. Okay, yes?
The way you describe it, that when we identify with something completely, what happens to the dualism? I mean, we use this term very often, mean that we identify with something.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Then there's a seeming disappearance of the duality, but not really. We could use an example of, for example, in the Chunjuk, in the Bodhicaryavatara, in the chapter on knowledge or wisdom there, Prajna. There are different reasons given for the non-self of the individual. There's no true self of an individual. It goes through the skandhas, right? For example, saying that the body is not the self, right? And then it takes different parts of the body, right? And it goes through each part one by one, saying, is that the self, right? So it takes the flesh, the blood, the bones, the hair. So we take the hair and say, is the hair me? Right? This is a kind of an idea that we have. We identify with our hair, right? If the hair is beautiful, we say, I'm very young and beautiful and I feel good and others like me, right? It's all me, you know, as if the hair is me. Right? If the hair is starting to get gray and it's getting dry and it falls out, and then maybe one starts to feel older and weaker and thinks that people don't like me. You know, it's the hair is me, right? One identifies with the object, right? And that's an incorrect identification. It doesn't remove the duality and reinforces it.
Would that be why it's called equivalent formulation? Because it's how we perceive it. Can you say that?
It's the equivalence between the term used and the object is part of the assumption. You know, because you assume that the object exists separate from the consciousness, then the term is assumed to be equivalent to that object. So we mix the object and the term. As soon as you have the term book, then you think you have that term itself represents that object perfectly, right? As if there was a complete natural correspondence between the sound book and the object. To go further into the point of language and such, and how that functions, we need another text, actually. In the distinguishing the middle from the extremes, in the fifth chapter, there's a verse in the 10 different points under the Vipassana, where language is one of them. And then it goes into how names function. There is no inherent correspondence between the term and the object it refers to. Why? Because the term itself is only a matter of setting some letters together in a certain order. And then, once they're in that order, then getting used to that those letters are in that order. And then, when you have that order and that familiarity, then one associates that sound or then that connection, that combination of letters with an object. But there's no inherent relation between the two. So if you take the Tibetan word for book, it doesn't sound at all like the English word or the Italian word and so on. So it's obvious that, you know, if one thinks about it a bit, that there's no inherent relation between language and objects. It's man-made, it's artificial connection. So, this is fine as an analysis, but in terms of our experience, we mix the name and the object. And that gives us the impression that the object is truly existent as an objectively outer existent thing. This is comparable to a well-composed painting in which there appears to be three-dimensionality even though there is none. So if you look at a good painting, it seems that the tree in the painting is maybe further away than the house. But actually they're on a flat canvas, they're both equally close to you. But the illusion is that the one is closer than the other. Similarly, the appearance of that which involves a duality of perceived and perceiver in not existing objectively as it appears is merely one's own mistaken interpretation, just as the strands of hair to a victim of cataracts and so on. So this eye sickness is, according to Tibetan medicine, is a disorder in the phlegm. You have three main kinds of illness in Tibetan medicine, and one of them is disorders in the phlegm. And through it, one sees black lines in front of the eyes which look like hairs, where there aren't any hairs. So that's the example. There, an object appears to the eye consciousness which is not there. There is no hair. Since what appears to the mind, namely the object, is not existent, even while appearing, anything whose appearance involves this duality, even though existing in an apparent sense, that is to say, even though existing from the perspective of our thoughts, could not be truly authentic in an objective sense. That is to say, it does not actually exist. It only exists from the perspective of one's own idea. For this reason, no reference have ever existed either, at any time, which could serve as the objects with respect to which designation could be assigned through the formulative process carried out by the inner rational mind, with its imputation of determinative labels on the basis of dualistic appearance. So this term referent is the in Tibetan dun, which is also translated meaning, because it goes with ming and dun, name and meaning. The name is the sound, the combination of letters. The dun is that to which that sound refers. So if you say dep in Tibetan, that sound refers to this book. So the referent is the meaning of the term, what the term refers to. This is stating that there are no referents, that there is nothing out there to which our language refers. When we say book, there is no book. There is this name, and there is an idea of a book, but there is no book. And not only now there's no book, but there has never been one at any time, which could serve as the object with respect to which the name book is assigned. Yes?
But there is, this thing is still there. I mean, without name, without...
Which one? I was talking about this. Oh, well, never mind.
without book, it's still there.
Yes, but let's say that a small child got a hold of that.
Yes.
Then probably wouldn't see a book, right?
Right.
He might see something to
eat. Yeah.
To eat or to... a toy or something. He wouldn't say a book anymore. He would have a different concept of it.
Yeah.
Right. So already there, the idea of that as being something as such starts to crumble a bit, starts to weaken.
As long as there, and also we have to remember,
we have a whole section coming about experience shared in common.
Yeah.
You know, there's a common level of experience where all of us together here agree that is book. So within that framework, one can say, okay, it exists, but only relative to that framework. As soon as you get outside that framework and a small child comes in, there's no book. Not from his concept, perspective. And if there can be a difference, you know, the very fact that there is a difference between his perspective and our own indicates that the object as such is not there. The ideas are there. The ideas are different. We'll get into more detail about why as we go along. So that is to say that this whole process of putting names with respect to what we think are reference is called imputation. Imputation means sticking on. It's like putting the tail on the donkey, right? First they... I don't know if you play this game. First you blindfold somebody, And then you give them the tail, right? And they have to find the donkey. And that's very much like the whole process of imputation, sticking the tail on. At some point, a name is just put on to a thing. It's completely arbitrary. Whether you call it book, whether you call it deb, you call it libre, you call it 40,000 other things. It's completely arbitrary. It's like, you just put it on there. And it has no more reality than that. Being but an imputation on the part of one's own concept, the complex manifold referred to as phenomena consists only in a process of interpretation. In brief, all phenomena which appear to form a dualism and are assumed to be dualistic have been depicted to be nothing other than a complete imputation, having no actual essence of their own, while nevertheless appearing. So that is the main paradox of how that it can appear if they don't exist. And that point will be taken up more as we go along. But now we've had the brief definition of phenomena, now we get the definition of pure being, which is the nature of phenomena. Second point is as follows. Second point means the definition of pure being. Moreover, being as such is here defined as being the suchness, in which there is no division between the being perceiver as well as perceived, a signifier as well as a signified. So the term suchness, that word is used because it refers to the ultimate nature of things taken from the perspective of their being unchanging. So we use the word suchness because it means such as they were before, such they will be later and always. So suchness indicates non-changeability. It's the way they are, the way they are-ness. Deshi-ni. It's the Tathagata. I'm not very good at Sanskrit. But it is that one. However you pronounce it, that's it. It's got a lot of T's in it. So, moreover, being as such, and that means pure being, fundamental nature, is here defined as being the opposite of the above, namely the suchness, the emptiness, in which there is no process of differentiation. And that's important, that there's no process, there's no mental process of differentiation between a perceived and a perceiver, which could appear as two. There is also no process of differentiation between a signified referent deriving from the assumption that they are so, as well as a signifier in the form of the conventions employed. So here we refute both the object perceived, the mind perceiving it, the term used to describe it, and the referent being described. All four of them are gone. And when they are gone, that is suchness. That is pure being. When there is not this duality of a mind perceiving it, conceptual mind perceiving an object and applying terms. So we're talking about an experience. Pure being is a state of being, right, in which there is no duality. So that is very, very difficult to understand. And the rest of the text will be the attempt to explain it. So not very much is explained here. It's kind of presented to open the questions, to get the debate started. So it's a very provocative way. It poses the question without answering much yet, but goes on immediately to give the rationale, the reasoning for why the argument has been set up like this. So the third point is the rationale justifying the paradox represented by the lack of objective existence of that which nevertheless appears. Because what does not exist appears, delusion provides the cause for completely afflicted states, since things like illusory elephants appear. Hence, even what does exist does not appear. So we have two problems, that what does not exist appears, and what does exist does not. So it's worse than we thought. So then, the argument then is, if either the lack of existence or the appearance were missing, delusion and being free of delusion, and likewise states afflicted in every respect and thorough refinement, would be unjustified. So, if this statement is not true, that it is something not existing that appears, then you can neither justify samsara nor nirvana. Well, that's what the we would have no explanation of suffering or of the state free of suffering if it's not something non-existent that appears. And the commentary goes into why.
You mean if things are as they appear?
Yeah, if things
are as they appear, then we have no, we can't justify that there isn't suffering.
Right, that's right.
Is that
right, if what appears exists, then to perceive it as existing would not be a delusion.
Yes.
So there would be no reason for this state of suffering.
So
how is suffering then defined? The suffering would still be there.
Pardon?
I mean, that the paradox would be that the suffering will be there still, but we will have no way to explain it. Is that
no
way of suffering to be defined?
No, if one's... a perception is correct, right? Then one is a Buddha. If you are perceiving reality, you are a Buddha. If your experience of things is in complete harmony with their reality of what they really are, you are a fully realized being, right? So then for a fully realized being there is no suffering.
So how is suffering then defined?
Is he going to go into that? How is suffering defined?
Well, let's hear what the commentary says first. Before conducting the debate, we have to have the text. Suva jab song yenang pecha lo ma song.
Tada kache lezo.
Tata drupsul na lezo.
Ah, chik tata de.
Mane. Maybe non se tripani.
Quen in the moon joint. German nineteen saw nine. May nine you talk and tepa.
La.
Don't bat data tripate. Oh,
yeah.
Hey, Abuyer. That Jeran saw me nine you talk it and come on. So Miranda.
So Rimshi says, you are all the paradox of something not existing appearing like a dream. But the fundamental nature of mind, which is the clear light, is not a paradox of something non-existent appearing. It is completely free of all delusion. Because it is what, in terms of the reality of things, what does not exist as it seems, but nevertheless appears, that delusion, like the illusory appearances associated with cataracts, provides the cause for the occurrence of all states which are afflicted in every respect. So here is the definition of suffering. States afflicted in every respect is suffering. The cause of that is delusion, which is connected with the delusory appearances, the projections, the confused appearances that are experienced. Because it is on the basis of their appearing to be a duality that the dualistic assumption is entertained, and on such a basis that the various tendencies are formed. So, since things appear to be dualistic, they are assumed to be dualistic. Because they are assumed to be dualistic, this creates a habit in the mind. Because of the habit, the dualistic appearance recurs. So it's circular. This could be illustrated by such examples as beautiful men in dreams. The text actually says women, but Rinpoche added this foreign word. He said we need both the appearance of men and women in dreams to make the example complete. And things like the forms of illusory elephants, which do not exist apart from the hypnotic influence of the illusionist's materials and charms, but which nevertheless appear. The case is similar for any other phenomenon as well. What does not exist nevertheless appears. Hence, even what does exist from the outset as the fundamental ground, objective reality, which is the freedom from the two forms of self, does not appear to ordinary beings.
So, objective reality, reality being what?
Objective reality is the freedom from the two forms of self. So the delusion is, the confused idea is based on there seeming to be a dualistic appearance. One takes it to be really dualistic. Because one thinks there is a truly existent outer object, that would be the self-entity of phenomena. And because one thinks there's a truly existent perceiver, that is a personal self. But objective reality is free of both of those forms of self. But what actually exists does not appear. For example, in a dream, there is the appearance of, for example, a flower, which in every way looks like a flower in the dream. And due to the habit of seeing any appearance as being separate from the mind perceiving it, immediately in the dream one takes that flower to be something separate from oneself. So one will relate to it in some way or other, like wanting to go and pluck it, or some way liking it, or reacting in some way, as if it were separate from oneself. However, the flower doesn't actually exist there. There's no essence of a flower. It has no substantial essence as an object, even though it appears. And because the flower is not present, then the inner perceiving mind, which is the thought that is a flower, also has no essence. It has nothing to refer to. So also it doesn't exist. So the object and the perceiver don't exist, even though the whole thing appears. But what really does exist, namely the emptiness of the duality of perceived and perceiver, does not appear. So that consciousness which is empty of the duality of perceived and perceiver is that mind out of which the dream arose. But that mind which is empty of duality is not what you experience in the dream when you see the flower.
Is that empty mind, is that clear with luminosity? Is that the clear luminous mind?
At this level of explanation is the Chittamatra explanation, explaining it in terms of that the ultimate consciousness is the consciousness empty of duality of perceived and perceiver. So that's the terminology of the Chittamatra, but it corresponds to what in the Shinto Madhyamaka would be called the consciousness, which is clear light.
Is that a given when you say, when you speak of the emptiness? When is it a given that it should be already included?
It depends. Well, these different terms go with different levels of explanation, different levels of view. And there are ways in which they are similar and ways in which they're different. So to find out exactly how they're the same and how they're different and how they apply and all of the different characteristics, then one has to go through the levels of view one by one. But in general, one could say that the Chittamatra consciousness, self-aware, self-illuminating consciousness, empty of the duality of perceived and perceiver, is equivalent to the clear light nature of mind of the Shentong Madhyamaka. But that's getting a bit ahead of ourselves, right?
Can I ask you something about that? Does it not appear, because if it appeared, it wouldn't be absolutely adequate?
Which? If which appears?
Well, we said that what does exist does not appear.
Yeah.
Does it not appear because because if it appeared, because appearance has to do with what doesn't exist.
Yeah, to give the complete answer, we need the section on pure being which goes into the definition of the non-conceptual wisdom, because we have to look at it for non-conceptual wisdom from the point of view of appearance and non-appearance to get the subtleties of it. But to give some kind of an answer, that fundamental mind, which is empty of duality, would not appear in a dualistic way. What appears in a dualistic way is a form, a sound, taste, smell, touch, thought. And because we are used to relating to things only in terms of those six, that is what we think of as experience, then in kind of common sense terms, then it is as if that true nature of mind never really appears to us. It never appears from the perspective of a deluded consciousness, a conceptual mind. That's the point.
It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. It doesn't appear to at all. It doesn't appear to ordinary beings.
Yeah. Yeah, in the commentary it says it does not appear to ordinary beings because what appears to ordinary beings always appears from the point of view of conceptual mind. Mm-hmm. And it does appear to a realized being because a realized being is able to contact something which is not an object of conceptual mind. Something which transcends objects of conceptual mind. Because it is as just explained, there are logical grounds for asserting samsara and nirvana, delusion and liberation. So now we get back to the argument. Otherwise, these would be unjustifiable. If there were no such complementary relationship, that is, if either of these two, the lack of objective existence or the appearance of the non-existent, were missing, the existence of both what are referred to as delusion and being free of delusion, likewise states afflicted in every respect and thorough refinement would be unjustified in every sense. So then the text goes into more detail about that. So if there were no lack of objective existence, but duality existed and were present in the way it appears, to perceive it in that way could not be justified as delusion or a distortion, in which case delusion would not be reversible by any means, and nirvana would be excluded in every respect. So, to say that the opposite way around, if what appears to us actually existed, then to see it that way would be correct. Since you would be perceiving, since the mode of appearance of things and their fundamental mode of being would be in harmony, you would be a Buddha. Since you are a Buddha, you would have no suffering. So the suffering that you experience would be a contradiction to what you actually are. Or, in fact, you would never get that far. I mean, if your perception really was completely in accordance with the genuine mode of the true reality of things, then there would be no suffering experienced at all. There would be no suffering experienced. Because the afflicted states come from the fact that one is perceiving something to be existent which it is not.
Through
the in Tibetan it's nyumongpa, right? The afflicted state. Which is, I mean, nyumongpa is desire, it's anger, desire, anger, stupidity, jealousy, pride, all of those are different degrees of afflicted states, all of which come from thinking that the object appearing is real. And because you think it's real, then either you desire it, and then you get different suffering connected with that, or you dislike it and get that kind of suffering, and so on. Because of the feeling, you create actions. Because of the actions, you create patterns. Because of the patterns, you reproduce the whole thing again and again. If, on the other hand, what does not really exist did not seemingly appear, it would not be possible for anyone to entertain a delusion involving perceived and perceiver. So if they were, you know, if... So let's take it from the other angle and say, okay, we won't claim it exists. We'll say it doesn't exist. If that thing that does not exist also had no appearance, made no appearance at all in any form, then delusion would not be possible. There'd be no confusion in the mind because there would be no experience. One would not be perceiving anything. And without any sort of perception or any sort of experience, then there's also no suffering. And if there's no suffering, then there would be no nirvana, because nirvana is the remedy for suffering. The whole path of refinement is called, you know, going through the path and applying the remedies to the afflicted states is needed because one is experiencing the afflicted state. If you're not experiencing any suffering, because there's no appearance of anything, then this would be like a state of dreamless sleep, which you never woke up from. And there would be no experience of any. You couldn't speak of mind, some sort of consciousness. So, if what did not really exist did not seemingly appear, it would not be possible for anyone to entertain a delusion involving perceived and perceiver, as a result of which there would be no base for complete affliction. Since that would not exist, neither would its reversal, designated the process of refinement, just as the non-existent horns of a rabbit cannot be clipped. Since rabbits don't have horns, you can't clip them. If there were no appearances, then there would be no need of nirvana. Or the path to nirvana. Therefore, there is a complementary relationship between the non-existent and appearance, such that the delusion of perceiving what does not exist as existing, as well as the related afflictive factors, become possible. So since we think that the appearance really exists, we have the suffering with all of its afflictive factors. Nirvana is also possible and can be attained through a path on which delusion is avoided by knowing the non-existent to be non-existent, even though it appears. So that brings us through the logical grounds for the argument. Then when the text goes on to analyze phenomena in pure being in terms of whether they're the same or different. Can we say that the phenomenon is its nature, or is it different from its nature? These two are not one and the same, nor do they differ. Because between that which exists and that which does not, a distinction exists and also does not. So we have to define a little bit closer what we mean, if you want to say they're the same or different. These two, and we're still talking about samsara and nirvana, or phenomena in pure being, are not one and the same in essence, nor do they differ in essence. Because between that which exists from the beginning as the fundamental ground, namely pure being, which is naturally pure nirvana, and that which does not exist fundamentally, but as a seeming appearance, namely host phenomena, consisting in the dualistic appearances which constitute the phenomena of samsara, and the difference is what? One exists and the other does not. Which one exists? Pure being. Pure being is genuine reality, dundampe dimpa, ultimate truth. In what sense does it exist? It exists from the beginning. There's never been any time at which it did not exist. How does it exist? As the fundamental ground of everything. And it's given the name naturally pure nirvana. And one speaks of nirvana in two ways. It says there are two nirvanas. It really means two senses in which nirvana can be understood. Naturally pure nirvana, or the nirvana which has been purified of stains. Naturally pure nirvana is what we a few days ago were calling base Mahamudra. Basic mind, the basic fundamental nature of mind, which from the beginning has been naturally pure nirvana. That is the mind out of which the dream appearances arise. And that is there, that exists, as the base for the arisal of all of the experiences. Whereas the form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts arising within that basic nature do not exist. What does it mean, do not exist? Do not exist fundamentally, but as a seeming appearance. And that's further defined as host phenomena. Host phenomena means any phenomena bearing pure being. That is to say, any phenomenon at all, anything that can be experienced in samsara. So since pure being exists and phenomena do not, there's a difference between the two. Is that part clear? Okay. So then comes the way in which they're not different. A distinction also does not exist because, and now three different reasons are given. If the one did not exist, its counterpart would not exist either. So if there were no the one, there would be no the other. Right? Without phenomena, no pure being. Without the fundamental nature, no appearances. They go together, inseparable. So since you never have one without the other, then you can't speak of them as different. They're simultaneous. They're never different. And then the second reason. Strictly speaking, pure being, other than being differentiated merely with respect to the lack of true existence of host phenomena, does not exist separately. So, pardon? This is from the point of view of the definition. What do you mean pure being? It means the exclusion of the of apparent being. You know, real being is the exclusion of apparent being. And it's nothing else. You know, if you say, genuine mind is that mind which is empty of dualistic mind. Right? And it's just a perspective to see it from. It's not that pure being is existing somewhere as a realm. You know, like when you die, you're going to go to pure being, as it's sitting up there waiting for you.
So
it's not a pure being is not a thing somewhere which you could go to, because it doesn't exist as a thing in itself, as having some sort of atoms. You know, that you could go in and say, I like green pure being or red pure being. It's not an entity as something separate from phenomena. So if you say, if we could get away from all of these nasty, disturbing flu phenomena, then we could get to pure being phenomena somewhere else, right? Maybe not in Germany, maybe we could go to Tibet and find it there, right? You know, if it's something, then you could find it somewhere. But since it's not a thing in itself, it cannot be found in a place as such. They don't exist. Strictly speaking, pure being is just differentiated with respect to the lack of true existence of host phenomena. It's not a thing. That's the second reason. The third, and the distinction between the existent pure being and the non-existent host phenomena is relative, being a differentiation merely with respect to what is to be adopted and what is to be rejected. So we're talking about the path, right? For a confused mind, you have to get the message through. Your confusion is not the correct state. You have to correct that. In order to correct it, one has to implant the idea of the correct state. And then you have something to compare your present state to, right? And something to aim for. And something to, to slowly come into harmony with. So, from the perspective of the path, you need to know what to do and what not to do. What is correct, what is incorrect. What is real and what is false. So, from the perspective of the path, what is to be adopted and what is to be rejected. Other than that, there's not even the slightest existence of an actual essence constituting a true existence of these as separate entities, which is precisely what is to be understood by their not being separate either. So, to put that third argument in a very brief way, and maybe to make it easy to understand, is that pure being does not exist as an object of thought. That would be the simplest way to say it. Anything that we can conceive of with our mind would not be pure being, if we can conceive it with our thinking mind. And pure being is the opposite of that. You know, if one can imagine, the thoughts go to there, to that point, right? And then anything that is not a thought, that is pure being. Okay, then, so I'm ready to be debated, then you can tear me apart.
But isn't it still citta matra, that pure being has to be beyond thought?
That's also citta matra, yeah. But it's also beyond objective thought.
Other than non-thought, that is pure being.
Yeah, pure being is not an object of the conceptual mind.
That is
resting in pure being. Yeah. If one is resting in the right non-conceptual state, there are five non-conceptual states that are not pure being.
Could you name some?
I'm pure being.
Pardon? Those five, you mean? What are they? They're coming in the text. So we don't have to worry about them today. But at least in terms of meditation, then, you know, what one is aiming at is to rest in the non-conceptual state. Non-conceptual wisdom. So that kind of opens the arguments and presents the main subject matter of the text, and then step by step it goes in deeper and deeper into that. So I think whatever may not be clear at this point will become clearer and clearer as we go along. But is there anything in what we had already that's not clear?
Is it right that they... that this system, it's the Shentong.
Well, the phenomena part of the text is Chittamatra, and the pure being part of the text is Shentong.
Shentong part, they postulate existence.
The Shentong.
Yes. But that what is existence is not apparent. To ordinary beings.
In either the Chittamatra or the Shentong way of looking at it, then ultimate mind does not appear to ordinary beings because ordinary beings experience things in terms of their concepts. And ultimate mind is not an object of concepts. And for that simple reason, it doesn't appear at all to ordinary beings, only to realized beings.
Do they have to be highly realized, or do they have to be like Arya?
Well, that again. We need another text, right? Then we need the distinguishing middle from the extremes. Then that goes into the paths and levels, and how. You know, on what you experience on which level. But basically, and also we get into it to a certain extent in this text already. It's the first level bodhisattva that is the first step of being a realized being. As soon as you have first level realization, you're a realized being. Then it increases for each bodhisattva level until final completion in Buddhahood. So the only one who experiences fundamental mind completely and in complete, where there's a total harmony between the way things are and the way they seem, is a Buddha. Mm-hmm.
Can you give an example of the first Burmese Bodhisattva, what kind of mind, state of mind she was in?
She.
Yeah, I might not.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should ask her. Yeah, well, in fact, that question will be answered in chapter... no, it is coming, in fact, where there's a description of what's experienced on the different bhumis. So it's a very complete picture. Then she'll tell us. Yeah.
I want to ask a deterministic question. It's really stupid and basic.
Never mind.
Whose idea were the five senses?
Yeah, I heard
what's the point of all this differentiation with sounds and light and things from that?
Yeah, I heard everything was going very well until the Greeks, you know, and then
I'm always stupid, very stupid.
No, it's not at all. It's not. It's the natural question, and the answer would be that if you think of the dream example, then where does the appearance come from in the dream?
Mind.
Yeah. So nobody invented that for you, you know, and then said you have to have it like you have. You should experience this, right? You're there in the dark. Nobody else is around. Everybody else is having a party somewhere. And you're completely by yourself, and suddenly you're experiencing something. Right? And why? That's the question. Right? Where does the arisal of appearance come from? The Chittamatra answer is it comes from bhakchak, the habitual tendencies in the mind, the habitual patterns. For example, if you dream that you're being burnt by fire, that for the image fire comes from having seen fire in the daytime. So that seeing the image fire made an impression on your mind, which is somehow recorded and stored, and then plays back during your dream. So that's the bhakchak, right? When you experience the fire in the day, since it appeared as if it is a dualistic object, where it's separate from the perceiving mind, then you assumed that it exists dualistically as a separate object. And because of that assumption, you called it fire, and you got this experience which you could code it into your mind in this very clever way with this name. So you get this coding device. It's like a computer or something. So the term is like the coding device. It's the particular way that the mind plants the seed of the habitual pattern. And through having planted that seed, then it's there in your mind. And as soon as it gets the proper conditions, then it manifests. So what's the proper conditions? Can be anything. For example, you're sleeping in a hot room. So it's very hot, and this feeling of being hot produces the image, fire in the dream. Then, because you have the habit of something that appears to be dualistic, you assume it is, then also in the dream, you assume that is actually fire existing there. And because of that assumption, then you can have the suffering of being burnt by fire. As soon as you recognize this dream, you see there's no fire even there. So how could there be suffering from fire? There's no fire. So it's from the perspective of a deluded mind that the appearance which has projected because of the patterns is assumed to be a truly existent object, and therefore has the capacity to cause suffering. So it's this the key term there is delusion. Because of the delusion, because of the assumption of true existence for what appears, the suffering happens. And so it's this delusion that is the point to be corrected in this whole analysis of phenomena in pure being. Yeah, it's simultaneous. So then the big question then remains, what is non-conceptual wisdom? And that's the main subject of the whole second half of the text of pure being. I mean, looking at what pure being is, the main thing to understand is non-conceptual wisdom. So I think that maybe gives us a good picture of what we're getting into. So now you're warned not to come tomorrow. And whenever the other group is finished, we'll meet back either back here or upstairs.